All right, we're back with the great Aaron Gwynn, Brad Kelly, and myself, Kevin Kelson. We're on the After Dark episode. We're going to talk more about Faulkner, who...
Ooh.
Yeah, Faulkner has stumbled drunkenly into the chat.
Yes.
hey, I want to say again, great job, guys. That was
thanks.
A lot.
Oh,
of
that
fun.
Was a bunch of fun, man.
Yeah,
I
thanks,
really
Aaron.
Enjoyed
you brought
it.
The you brought the heat. Those readings you shared with us in particular, man. That one from A Fable, I had goosebumps.
That's awesome.
Yeah,
that's awesome.
Yeah, that was. I mean, the Absalom one is amazing too. It's one of my favorite passages, but. Ooh, yeah.
Yeah, so, your students are lucky to have you. Yeah.
You're very sweet.
I can tell that you're one of the good ones, right? You're not
oh,
going
man,
through
I appreciate
emotions.
That. No, I love it. Mm-hmm. I love these kids. I loved, you know, getting up and hamming it up is part of it, right? You kind of get up there, you ham it up, you have fun with it. You know, you try to like just kind of get in touch with that thing that made you want to do it in the first place. That's probably the best thing you can do.
Yeah,
I think that's the best thing you can do, right?
Yeah.
I think these things are meant to be read aloud, and they're meant. He's a very theatrical writer, and he lived, 100%. I think you could say, a very theatrical life.
Yes, absolutely.
Absolutely. Yeah, an eccentric dude. Well, so we're starting something new with these After Dark episodes. Usually we talk, hitherto we've talked about the kind of the making of how did we, go about doing it? What did we research? And I want to get to that too, but I also want to follow through with our new value proposition for the Patreon listeners, which is, you know, we're going to save one anecdote or a story.
Oh, man.
It's a little juicy. So
I got juicy.
Okay, all right, give
juicy.
Us the juice.
I think Brad does too, so
yeah,
we got right, to get double
it,
juice.
Oh, yeah, man.
So Faulkner writes this, this kind of genre book, we talked about this on the pod, is Sanctuary. And so in Sanctuary, a Mississippi debutante named Temple Drake is abducted by this psychopathic pimp from Memphis, and she's just, you know, taken, kidnapped to this Memphis brothel, and there this pimp named Popeye ties her to a bed and savagely rapes her with a corn cob while he stands at the foot of the bed, you know, whinnying like a horse, right? So in the late 30s, Faulkner was stopped in the streets of Oxford, Mississippi by a very proper Southern lady, and she of course recognized him, and she said, "Mr. Faulkner, I read your novel Sanctuary, and it was so horrible what happened to Temple Drake, and I thought about you, son, and I realized that you were not that horrible man, Papa, who would do such a thing, but you were that reporter who went after that poor girl and would not rest until she was returned to her home." And Faulkner stood there, you know, while she went on and smoking his pipe. Then he blew smoke in her face and said, "Madam, I was the corn cob."
Oh. Whoa. Oh, goodness.
He didn't, until he was famous, like real famous, the people in Oxford didn't like him a whole lot.
Yeah, he was kind of a son of a bitch, man. Yeah. I mean, he liked to ruffle feathers. He liked to do it in his books. He liked to do it in his life.
Yeah. And I think one thing I remember reading from the biography is they didn't, that's such a great story, because I could just picture him, like, you know, probably hungover from the day before. Like,
oh my gosh.
But one thing I remember reading in the biography was he did the Hollywood thing and he kind of hated it, but he made good money, yada, yada, yada. But people in Oxford didn't really start paying attention until one of the films he wrote had its premiere in Oxford. And then it was like, oh, we have a
that's so typical too, right? Oh, he's the real deal here. The movies, he's in the movies,
and that would just piss Faulkner off. Of course, right? There'd be nothing more infuriating. It's like, oh, now you like me? Now you like me?
Right.
Yeah.
But yeah, what can you do? I mean, you gotta. Yeah. It's so funny too, that for him to have that that career in Hollywood, of all of the writers whose work I know fairly well, he is maybe the last person on the list that I would say could make a successful go of it screenwriting.
I mean, for real, right?
Yeah.
I mean, there's nothing about him except his genius that suggests that is temperamentally a screenwriter of in any kind. I mean, you don't read Faulkner for the punchy dialogue.
No.
You know, in fact, everything you read Faulkner for is kind of not part of the movies.
And I mean, it's not the most powerful part of the writing necessarily, but one of the most powerful aspects is stuff you can't even really film.
That's right.
You know,
that's right.
That whole bit you read from a fable, the greatest power from that is sort of this imagery that's conjured that, you know,
that's
it's
right.
sort of existing in the character's mind. So, you know, how are you going to film Benji's perspective?
Like, yeah. Every attempt to make anything, bring any of it to film or television has been disastrous. There's an adaptation of his short story Barn Burning that's not horrible, where I think Tommy Lee Jones plays Ab Snopes. I think that's the character. But Tommy Lee Jones is in it, and it's okay. But I mean, you miss Faulkner is what you miss.
Yeah. I could see some of the short stories maybe working. Like, I could see somebody pulling off A Rose for Emily as a film.
A really great director, right?
Yeah.
If he had the right, he'd have to make it his own or her own or whatever, right? But like with the right approach, you know, like a Jordan Peele thing almost, right? It would have to be like and it would work better as a kind of like Twilight Zone episode or a Black Mirror episode.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like,
like
a 30-minute kind of punchy kind of thing.
Right? Yeah. 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 Where you just inhabit this world for a little bit and you get the, And that's not very easily translatable.
What do we make of this weird new cult of people who write somebody like Faulkner off as a tired old dead white man from the South and the slave legacy and all the rest? What do we say to somebody who's cynical about Faulkner and maybe even like id poll aside just goes, ugh, Faulkner? You hear it sometimes. People just don't get it or don't like it.
Yeah.
What do you say to them?
Well, to any of those people who have that response to any genius, whether it's, you know, Faulkner or Toni Morrison or Ingmar Bergman or whoever, I would say, okay, you're having a political or ideological reaction as opposed to an aesthetic reaction. And one day, my friend, people will look at you and judge you by the same metric. They'll say, oh my gosh, I can't believe, I mean, there are categories we haven't even dreamed up yet that these younger folks are trespassing against.
Yeah.
Right. And so if you subject anyone to the morality of your time as opposed to their time, I mean, we're all screwed. All of us.
Hey, look, I mean, that's the kind of hidden or subtextual thesis of this show is, look, if you want any culture to stand whatsoever, you have to have at least an interest in learning about the person and potentially forgiving. Some things are unforgivable.
Yeah. Sure.
But there are, well, you know, I've been going back to church. There's, you know, I really do believe in forgiveness and regardless, not to get too in the weeds there, but it's like, what you can't separate the art from the human. And that's sort of what this show's about. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
Well, I believe, both of you know this, you're artists, you're writers, you know that the product that you end up with on the other side of that equation, like, it's you, but it's you in the sense of ventriloquism. Like, whatever you are has gone through such a weird transformative process that I don't have much problem separating any artist from the art in the sense that whatever's over there, because you guys have too. You've met too many writers and you're like, you wrote this?
Right.
You did this?
There's nothing. You're a shriveling mess.
Yeah.
You're
right.
And no offense. I mean,
you're like totally absolutely.
Yeah, you're like a bro. Like, what is going on here? Right. Yeah, yeah,
what's
yeah.
going on? Like, how right. did you do this? Right. And that is the transformative, beautiful thing about art that people, like a lot of us, are scribbling messes from time to time, yeah. Sometimes perpetually. Yeah. But that Faulkner is clearly like this guy who has tremendous ambition, but is quite confused and is, a liar and, running around his wife and, in other words, human, right?
Yep.
And a weirdo, and I hope that the person who wrote Absalom's a weirdo. I hope that just like a stock trader on Wall Street can't just dash that off in his spare time. Like, please tell me that dude's fucked up in some way. Right.
Right. Right.
So yeah, that's how I feel. I don't know.
Yeah. I'm right there with you, man. I feel like I don't think you can't throw away any of it. If someone wants to read this, the body of work that Faulkner left behind and say they don't like it, well, okay. Taste, everybody's got their taste. I don't get that necessarily. I don't know why you wouldn't like it, but to just dismiss him based on his identity or based on the fact that he comes from a certain tradition or whatever, it seems like you're kind of missing the point of what art is and what art does wholesale.
Absolutely. And I would say, it's fine that a lot of younger people are down for social causes and, hey, it's great. Would you have that courage when it counts? That's right. The question. And yeah. Faulkner had it when it counted.
Yeah.
Like Faulkner was on the side of civil rights and freedom for African Americans. And he was on the side of that vocally, publicly when it counted.
Right.
When he was in the minority. So,
right. Right.
We know where he stood.
Yeah.
Yeah. In the deep South.
So then to come back and say one of his books is problematic because it doesn't handle race exactly the way you think it should be in 2021. It's insane.
And also, okay, you stand there making that judgment. Okay, what have you done? What have you subjected yourself to? Someone was mean to you on Twitter?
Yeah, right.
Right? and maybe that ain't nothing. Okay, right. Fine. But do you have bona fides that can stack up against Faulkner's?
Yeah.
No, yeah.
Nobody does.
Nobody does.
I think a lot of that is a case of almost like, oh, the Beatles, they're overrated. Right. It's like, okay, sure. All right, we get it. You're cool. You've thought a lot about music, all right?
Right.
Tell me about the Beach Boys record that everybody talks about. I got you. Right. Okay, great.
Well, a lot of this stuff, I actually can, I have a lot of students who are kind of rolling that way now. And I get that when you're young, and when I was young, I didn't know how to differentiate myself. I wanted to be somebody. I wanted to be unique. But I hadn't had a chance to do anything yet. I hadn't had. So the way I think, and this is just generation. I'm a Gen Xer. But the way I and my friends, I'm not saying this is the way other people should do it. The way we did it is like, okay, we haven't had time to do anything. Judge us by what we like.
Right.
Right. It's like, well, I like Quentin Tarantino and I like Stanley Kubrick and I like The Clash. Right. And so you can't judge me on what I've written because I haven't written anything yet. But what stands for me is that I like this stuff. And you find people that like that stuff and that's your tribe. Yeah. I feel like that's a little different than what's going on now.
Yeah, there is some of that though. But yeah, once you hit 30 or 40, you're right. What your favorite, once you hit 30 or 40, your list of top 10 movies doesn't count as a personality.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. But I mean, that's the thing I tell my students. I just say, hey, it's a lot of your beliefs are probably really good to have. I mean, it's good to be, man. I think it's good to be against racism.
Yeah.
I think it's great to be against racism. It's freaking horrible.
Right. Sure.
Right? But like,
it's like, also this, it's the easiest thing to leverage right now as an American is to be vehemently vocally anti-racist, right? Without any nuance, like, of course.
Yeah.
Right.
It's just great to be against racism, but like in your particular case, like the student, like has that been tested?
Yes.
Like, have you been tested? Have you been on the line? Have you walked across the bridge toward cops with batons about to get sick dogs on you like John Lewis? Have you done that?
Yeah.
Yeah. Right. You can say like Martin Luther King is problematic, but did they turn the fire hoses on you? You know
right,
what I mean? So,
Right. Yeah, no, totally. I get it. And I feel that way about a lot of this criticism, that it's sort of just a wholesale way of cutting down people who've put in the work to read and to familiarize themselves with, you know, these great authors. I think it's a yes and thing. Yes, let's read Faulkner and then also read Zadie Smith.
And you can do both.
Read all of it.
And if there are all of it. If there's great art that was overlooked from, say, Faulkner's time period or any time period because of, you know, racial reasons or gender reasons or political reasons, I am all for those coming back, those being resurrected. You know what I mean? Like, if we missed somebody who was writing at the same time as Faulkner, who just happened to be fill in the identity, and we missed them because of that, bring that person up. Like, I want to know who that 100%. Person is. I want to know what that work is. Yeah, no, but I'm not going to not read Faulkner because...
I think the only thing that I've seen about this vis-a-vis, you know, this whole kind of debate, I mean, we're talking about kind of like cancel culture stuff, you know, with Faulkner.
Yeah.
There was a Drew Gilpin Faust article in The Atlantic this past summer. And I like her. She wrote a book that was a finalist for the National Book Award about the Civil War called This Republic of Suffering. She's a good writer and someone I respect. So she writes an article for The Atlantic, and it's kind of like, can an author be better than their time and their art and their fiction and still be a person of their time and their life? And the answer is obviously, of course, yes.
Yeah.
And Faulkner was that. So she talks about some of the things that Faulkner did that don't cool today they just aren't our standards, and that's all fine. But of course, she eventually comes down. I mean, the whole article is kind of like a clickbait thing. She comes down as like, well, Faulkner actually, you know, really cared about civil rights, and his novels all expound like, you know, liberty for all people and you know, looking beyond race and a really nuanced view of, I mean, so she ends up saying, of course we should read Faulkner. But then I'm like, I only clicked on this because you're like, should Faulkner be canceled? And you know?
Yeah. Right.
So it's just like, I mean, basically you're saying, should we Faulkner? Yes. Well, I knew that.
Yeah.
Why did I put myself through this?
That's hilarious.
It's silly. It's silly, right? And I get it. I mean, all these magazines, and I subscribe to The Atlantic. I like articles in The Atlantic. Some I don't. But like, they're all going away. They're going away.
Yeah. Yeah.
And they need ad dollars. I mean, they need ad revenue. They need to survive.
Yeah.
Okay, fine.
I don't want to say something controversial, so at the next conference, everybody can kind of sip their drinks and talk about
There's a take arms race going on right now, right? For attention. So it's like, well, I got to say something more provocative than the thing that somebody said 3 days ago that got all that attention. Right? Like, so yeah, you end up saying, you know, people end up saying outlandish things.
Well, it's also like on Twitter, at least, which is its own atmosphere when I was on there, the sense I got, like there is among a certain crowd, a kind of moral one-upsmanship.
Yes.
So if someone says Black Lives Matter, and I think people are like, well, obviously, right?
Yeah.
And then someone's like, well, but Black trans lives matter.
Right.
You're like, okay, but it's like,
that's cool,
are you
too.
Just adding more nouns to the, like, in order to like,
I thought the first one covered that.
It's just puritanism. It's the new puritanism. You have to one up your neighbor to show how much more valorous,
how faithful you are. Yeah.
It's not the virtue I have a problem with. If you know, you want to, if you want to be down with people who are marginalized and everything, I'm with you.
Yeah.
But it's when you're like, oh, you support Black people, but not Black trans people.
Right.
It's like, well, of course, but like now you're just trying to one up me. And and what are we doing? And honestly, if we agree on all the same stuff. Like, right. We're not even against each other. Like, we basically believe the same stuff, except I don't believe in being sanctimonious.
Yeah. It's the sanctimoniousness and the cheapness of it that I think a lot of people object to. And totally agree. Well, guys, you know, this has been great. Did Brad, you have, was there an anecdote that you
I
had?
I had a little one. It's a little sidetracked. So the depth of Faulkner's degenerate alcoholism. I don't know if I managed to capture that. And you know, this show is tricky because we bring up these people we love, like Faulkner or Brando in the last episode. These people that we appreciate them. I mean, we've never done a show on somebody who at least one of us wasn't a big fan of. And then we're pointing out often their failings. And so I want to reflect how screwed up Faulkner was alcohol wise. So he would go on these crazy benders, right? And oftentimes they were when he was away from Mississippi, not always, but oftentimes this was bad. Meta, this woman that he'd had an affair with, got married to somebody else. And so the fling was over. This is in like 36 or 37, I guess. And he's in New York, and she happens to be in New York as well. And he's staying in the hotel that he normally stays in, the Algonquin. And he goes on a bender. Her being there, and she's inaccessible now, and it's over, and he's stuck in this loveless marriage, and yada, yada, yada. So he hits the bottle very, very hard. For 3 days, Estelle couldn't get a hold of him calling at the hotel. I'll just read this thing real quick from the biography. Given the presence of Meta Rebner, in New York, her name used to be Carpenter. Now it's Rebner because she's married. It was not surprising that Faulkner should seek refuge in alcohol. As it happened, he had come back to the hotel in a state of considerable inebriation one night and lost consciousness in his bathroom, falling against a steam pipe. He was eventually discovered in his underpants, face down on the tiles of the bathroom floor, insensible. Even worse, he had sustained a horrible burn on his back near his left kidney. It would take years to recover fully from this injury, which required multiple skin grafts and constant attention. So he just by himself in his hotel room, losing his mind, guzzling whiskey, blacks out for as long as a day, falls against the steam pipe, third degree burns on his back that bothered him for years.
Oh my gosh.
Just an irredeemable drunk, you know?
That is a level of drunk. Yeah, that you don't even really want to mess around with. No. When you end up in the ER, when you end up in, and I can't quite recall when AA came about.
I was just thinking about that, man.
Yeah.
I was just thinking about that.
Yeah. It was in the 50s. There was a time when Estelle was thinking about joining because she was a crazy drunk too.
It looks like AA really started to kick off in the mid-30s, but probably became right. Okay. It had its beginnings there, but if you know anything about the program, and I'm afraid I do, if you know anything about the program, it took off, you know, later. But there, I mean, he's one of these just classic cases where they could have possibly saved his life, but if you're ending up in the hospital and whatnot, there's no drinking.
He was ending up in the hospital. When he was in his 50s, he was ending up in the hospital all the time, mostly from alcohol.
So when you say sanatorium, is that like kind of like a withdrawal situation?
Yeah,
like withdrawal.
Yeah, they would dry him. They would dry him out. Like, and it was bad enough that he couldn't just quit cold turkey. Like, he had to taper. He had to taper.
So they have to really, they have to have you either on meds or have to taper you, step you down off alcohol.
Yeah, I think back then, I don't think they had really good medicines to actually use pharmaceuticals. So I think, you'd get half a shot of whiskey every couple hours or something.
They'll taper you. Yeah. They'll put you now on Ativan. It's lorazepam or whatnot. And I don't know how long that was in use. But you mentioned too that he had electroshock therapy.
He did have electroshock.
Well, you know, they still will give electroshock therapy to people as a kind of final last resort. But when he was receiving it would have been awake.
Yeah.
Just the kind of awful. Awful
you know,
vision.
Well, mm-hmm. yeah, you know, well, it's David Foster Wallace had electroshock therapy.
Poor guy.
Yeah.
Poor guy.
Yeah. Some people swear by it. I don't want to be too biased one way or another, but I think back, you sort of go like, my God, the image we have is people against their will and all the rest of it. But there are certain cases of just hopeless depressives who are quite literally, it's the rope or... you know, we'll sedate you and do it. And it works for some people. So no judgment.
I think for Faulkner, it was like, hey, you know, this is killing you. This drinking, maybe this will, he called it reshuffle the deck.
Yeah, so, I bet. Yeah. The weird thing is, like, you think about a writer like Cormac McCarthy, who's clearly in the Faulknerian tradition, the Melvillian tradition. And McCarthy has produced masterpieces in his 60s and 70s. That would be unthinkable for Faulkner, right? Like, he had destroyed himself so much with alcohol. Yeah. McCarthy said that he realized very early that the alcohol was an occupational hazard of writing, and that it would take away from his gift. You know, this is a guy who turned, what, he's 87?
Something like that, yeah.
He's still... He's got a big novel hanging out there he's been working on still. He's still in the game big time.
Yeah, I mean, it goes without saying, get the help you need, AA or whatever else. Yeah, it's tough. I mean, and we have now more information about it and that funny connection between booze and writers. I can't explain it. I don't know what it is, but it's there and it's real.
Yeah. And I think in Faulkner's time, I don't even know if he necessarily called it alcoholism. I mean, eventually in his life he did. But, I think there was a lot more of a like, you know, you're just drinking too much. There wasn't a recognition of the psychological depth that was involved in having a real problem, you know.
Well, if you admit that exists, then you're like... Then you have to look at your own drinking.
If
the doctor at, Oxford Hospital... has to be like, well, Bill, I think you might be an alcoholic.
Right. Well, this was one thing we started talking about AA. Estelle, I don't know if she ended up going into AA, but she was considering it. And that concerned William a lot because
I bet it did.
If she wasn't drinking anymore, then like the next domino to fall is he's not going to, you know. He didn't want to give it up.
It often works that way too. Yeah. People who go into the program and go into treatment, in many cases, you have to completely change your friend circle. You got to change your group because it's a very social. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You want to threaten a junkie, tell him you'll put him in rehab, man.
Yeah.
I mean, no.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. So
well, that's a shock to the system as well. Lads, it's like he had a high genetic burden too. Anyway.
Yeah. No. I'm sorry to cut you off, but this was tremendous.
It was great.
I really enjoyed it. Aaron, you have to come on another episode. And
anytime, gents.
I don't know what else to say other than buy one of Aaron's books.
Absolutely.
Aaron, is there a top? Which one, if you could tell somebody, read this one?
I am proudest of all God's children. That's the most recent book.
It's a great book, man.
Thank you, man.
Yes, it really is.
I'm proudest of that. More proud of that than anything I've ever written. And I would tell people to start there if they're interested in starting.
Yeah. And how does a podcaster get a signed copy of that? I'll have to.
I'll slide
into your DMs.
You might have to share some Floki with them. I don't
know. Floki to Valhalla. It happened during this episode.
Yeah.
Amazing. Amazing. Maybe Faulkner would have an NFT and he'd be a Bitcoin trader for all we know.
Yeah. I hope not.
Yeah. He'd write the first novel on the blockchain.
Yeah. That'd be great. All right, guys.
A lot of fun,
man.
Yeah.
Take care, last.
All right, take care.